Do it for the pictures. I'd like to welcome everyone to the last year of today's program, although as many of you know, the program is continuing tonight with a community lecture open to men and women here in our Torah. The lecture will be given by Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, who is an esteemed member of the audience right now. And we are very, very excited to hear Dr. Lichtenstein speak to us twice over the coming days, or today and tomorrow, tonight, as I just said, and tomorrow morning as our keynote speaker, and we welcome her to Chicago for, I think, her second time, so thank you for coming. And I would also like to thank you for participating in what has become our largest Yerachei Kala yet. We have had over 100 participants. And maybe more will even come tomorrow, so you never know. There's nothing like a mother in a child's life. I think every single one of us knows that instinctively, either because we have been a child ourselves, or for some of us, maybe because we have or are mothers. Unfortunately, some of us have learned that lesson more sharply because we may have experienced the loss of a mother, either our own or of a loved one, while others are, Baruch Hashem, still able to appreciate the presence of their mothers in their lives. I know I am. Thank God. Of course, as we see in almost every special relationship that exists, you know, amongst human beings, this special relationship is attested to in Tanakh as well. Just to name a few examples, starting from Sefer Bereishit, we know that Sarah had a very, very tender feeling toward Yitzhak, and even made her husband kick out his own son for the sake of her son. And we also are told that Yitzhak was not comforted after the loss of his mother until she was, so to speak, substituted by his wife, who was to be the future mother of his children. We're told something very similar about Yaakov and Rivka, his mom. We're told that Rivka had a special love for Yaakov Avinu. And we know that Yaakov followed her advice to deceive his father Yitzhak, even though it went against the core of who he was. Yaakov was the man of Emet, of truth, and yet he deceived his father because his mother told him to. And again, he listened to his mother when she told him to run away from home. Reuven felt an extremely strong connection to his mother. The first time we see that, he is bringing his mother flowers in the field. When he comes back from the field and he sees his mother, he presents her with flowers. And we see the real depth of their relationship when he goes so far later in life as to dishonor his father for the sake of his mother. In the times of the Malachim, just skipping forward a little bit, we know also that Bathsheba had a very close relationship with her son Shlomo and was a very influential presence in his life. In fact, we're told in Sefer Malachim that she had her own throne next to his, and she was given an important governmental position known as the Eim HaMelech. She was the royal mother, the queen mother, however you call it in different societies. And we know, or we can conjecture at least, based on the presence of the king's mother's names. As Sefer Malachim goes on, we're always told not only who their father was, who was the previous king, but also who their mother was. And it's conjectured by scholars of the time period that that is because the Eim HaMelech position continued. And so we see that there has always been, throughout the annals of time, a very special relationship between a mother and her children. And Tanakh goes on to express that it's not just about there being a special relationship between a mother and her children, but also an instructive relationship, a relationship that requires teaching and learning. In fact, the first lesson that Shlomo HaMelech imparts to us, not so surprising because we know that he was so close with his mother Bathsheba, but the first lesson that Shlomo HaMelech imparts to us in Sefer Mishlei after he finishes his introduction appears in source number 1 in Mishlei Perek Aleph Pasuk Chet. And this is a very, very famous pasuk in which he tells us, Shema b'ni musar avicha ve'al titosh torat imecha. Listen, my son, to the rebuke of your father, and do not abandon the teachings of your mother. And there's a lot of ink spilled on what the difference is between musar avicha and torat imecha. What is the difference between what our fathers teach us and what our mothers teach us? For the sake of this year, I just want to point out a comment by the Ibn Ezra. In source number 1a, I just didn't want to mess up the rest of the source sheet. So source number 1a, the Ibn Ezra tells us Shema b'ni Musar v'gomer Torat Imecha, ki ha'isha chachama mora haderech ha'yishara livna. Because a wise woman teaches her son to go in the straight path. Kibat Sheva shahetai yasra limuel. Like Bat Sheva, who used to rebuke her son, Shlomo refers to himself as limuel in Sefer Mishlei, actually. So we see that according to the Ibn Ezra, the wisdom, the Torah, the teaching that the mother is supposed to transmit to her child is in order to keep him on the straight path. It's to transmit her values, to instill within him that which is important to her. That is Torah Imecha. That is what is important for a mother to transmit to her child. But what happens if the relationship between a mother and child is disrupted too early? Does the mother need more time to impart everything that is important to her? Will her lessons be left undeveloped, incomplete, abruptly ended before they can really take root? What happens if she's torn from her beloved child before she wants to be? Let's take that question, set it aside for a moment, put it on the back burner, and take a different turn, and you'll see how we're going to come back eventually to our question. There are two different psukim in Tanakh that seem to portray one comparison. Let's turn your attention now to source number 2, in Tehillim Perek Tzadi Tet Pasuk Vav. David HaMelech tells us the following: Moshe v'Aaron b'Kohanav u'Shmo Shmuel b'Korei Shemo Korim el Hashem v'Hu Ya'anim. David HaMelech here is comparing Moshe and Aaron on the one hand, who are Kohanim. So the Mefarshim try to understand when was Moshe a Kohen, and they say, oh, during the Sheva Yemei Miluim, right? The first 7 days before the Mishkan was, the first 7 days in which the Mishkan were being dedicated, Moshe was functioning as a Kohen. And Shmuel, as a Korei Shemo, someone who calls out to Hashem's name. So many of the Mefarshim there explain that it means that he's a Navi. They both, right, Moshe and Aaron on the one hand, and Shmuel on the other hand, are parallel to each other, in that they are Korim el Hashem v'hu ya'anein. They call out to God and he answers them. Right? This is what we think of when we think of Nevi'im. Nevi'im are able to speak to God and they hear the answer. We, who daven, can speak to Hashem, right? But we don't always know what that answer is. We don't always feel it. We believe that there is an answer. We just don't hear it, right? A Navi, however, right, as Russell Levitchik used to explain, really, it goes both ways. It's not just that we're talking to Hashem, but Hashem is talking to us. So here, David HaMelech compares Moshe and Aaron on the one hand with Shmuel on the other hand. And this is not the only time where we see such a comparison in Tanakh. Turn to source number 3 in Sefer Yirmiyahu. And here we have to understand the context a little bit. Hashem is so angry at Bnei Yisrael. This is right before the Chorban. Right? Yirmiyahu was the Navi, Jeremiah the prophet, before the Beit HaMikdash was going to be destroyed. And Yirmiyahu's purpose was to basically warn Bnei Yisrael, try to get them to change. But at a certain point, Hashem says, enough is enough. They're not changing. I want them out. And he warns Yirmiyahu not to daven. The Navi, who we just explained, one of his primary roles is to daven on behalf of Bnei Yisrael. Hashem says, sorry, Yirmiyahu, you can't do that anymore. And when Hashem delivers this hurtful message to Yirmiyahu, he says it as follows. Vayomar Hashem, in source number 3, Vayomar Hashem Eli, Yirmiyahu speaking, Hashem said to me, Im ya'amod Moshe u'Shmuel lefanai ein nafshi el ha'amazeh. Even if Moshe and Shmuel stood before me, I still would not be with this nation. Shlach me'alai, me'al panai v'yetzeu, right? Send them away from me. And so here for the second time, and here Hashem himself is comparing Moshe and Shmuel. Aaron's missing, so, you know, okay, we'll leave that for now. But in 2 Psukim, we have Moshe and Shmuel being compared to one another. And the Midrashim take this statement, these statements of parallelism even further and tell us in source number 5 in Midrash Mishlei, I'm sorry, in source number 4 in Shmuel Rabbah first, V'chei matzinu Moshe u'Shmuel shavin ka'achat. In fact, Chazal tell us, based on these Psukim, that Moshe and Shmuel are equal as one. Right, and they bring our pasuk in Tehillim as proof. Shneamar Moshe v'Aaron v'Kohanav u'Shmuel v'Korei Shemo. And in source number 5 in the Medrash and Mishlei, we're told something very similar. Because Chana davened so with such heartfelt prayer Third line in the source, Lefichach zachta. V'yatzah mimena ben, therefore she was worthy to have a child, shehaya zug l'Moshe v'Aaron, who is a pair, who is a partner of Moshe, or at least in greatness, of Moshe and Aaron. And so we see that based on these psukim, Chazal tell us that Shmuel was as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe and Shmuel are very similar to one another. Why? Why are these psukim comparing Moshe and Shmuel? Of all of our great leaders, and we've had many, many great leaders, why do the psukim and then Chazal choose to compare these two specific leaders? According to Chazal, it's because they share many life events. If you turn to source number 6, the Medrash in Shmuel explains. Ve'yomar Hashem Elai im ya'amol Moshe u'Shmuel lefanai, quoting the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, at motzei ma shekatuv bazeh, katuv bazeh. It's because things that you find written about Moshe in his life are also written about Shmuel in his life. Ze Levi v'ze Levi. They're both Levim. Okay. Ze bana mizvachot v'ze bana mizvachot. They both built altars. Ze melech al Yisrael v'Yehuda v'ze melech al Yisrael v'Yehuda. They both presided as leaders over a unified nation before the split in the kingdoms. Ze hikriv v'ze hikriv. They both brought sacrifices. Zebikriya v'zebikriya. Hashem called out to both of them, Vayikra el Moshe, Vayikra el Shmuel. V'ze b'hineni v'ze b'hineni. And they both responded very similarly with the word hineni. The Medrash then goes on to give us the psukim inside. Now we can add to these six parallels a few more. What's interesting about both Moshe and Shmuel is that they both indeed had a very, very close relationship with the Kohen Gadol at the time. A familial kind of relationship. Moshe was brothers with the Kohen Gadol. Aaron was his brother. Shmuel grew up in the Mishkan, raised by Eli HaKohen. And so he developed a father, he became like a father figure to him. He developed a very, very close paternal relationship with him. Hashem called out to both of them, not only with the word Vayikra, but he also doubled up their names. Right? If you turn to source number 7, the last Pasuk, in Pasuk Dalet, Vayomer Moshe Moshe, Vayomer Hineni. Hashem said Moshe Moshe twice, and in fact, we see the same thing with Shmuel in source number 8. In Shmuel Aleph Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yod, Vayikra Kepa'am Bepa'am Shmuel Shmuel. And Hashem said Shmuel Shmuel. They were both the ultimate shoftim of their generation, right? Remember that story that Moshe was sitting all day and B'nai Yisrael kept coming and coming and coming until they finally realized that, you know, they can maybe get lower judges, but he was still the ultimate shofet. He was still the highest level. Shmuel was the shofet of the generation. They both inspired B'nai Yisrael to get rid of Avodah Zarah. Moshe, first when he took them out of Mitzrayim to leave behind the Avodah Zarah that they had grown up with, and then after Chet HaEgel, Shmuel, we see in source number 9, in Shmuel Aleph Perek Zayin Pasuk Gimel, Hasiru at Elohei HaNechar mitochachem. Remove the foreign gods from your midst, v'ha Ashtarot, and the Ashtarot, which are another name for a foreign god, for Avodah Zarah. V'hachinu levavchem al Hashem, v'avduhu levado. Right? Prepare your hearts for Hashem himself. Worship Hashem by himself. They both interceded on B'nai Yisrael's behalf to Hashem. Moshe, I mean, this happened countless times, but for example, when they were afraid on the cusp of the Yom Suf that the Mitzrayim were going to kill them, Hashem, Moshe davened on their behalf. When Hashem wanted to decimate them after Chet HaEgel, and then again after Chet HaMeraglim, Moshe davened on their behalf. And we see it very clearly still in source number 9 that that Shmuel does the same thing. If you flip to the next page, in page 4, but still the same source, in Pasuk Hei, Shmuel says to the people, Kivtsu et kol Yisrael, gather all together, ha-mitzpata, in mitzpah, ve'et palel ba'atchem al Hashem, and I will daven for you on your behalf to Hashem. And in fact, in Pasuk Ted, he does so, ve'yizak Shmuel al Hashem ba'ad Yisrael, ve'ya'anehu Hashem. Shmuel does, in fact, intercede on B'nai Yisrael's behalf, just as Moshe had done. And Hashem responds to him, just as he had with Moshe. They are both very fascinatingly described as Ne'eman. If you turn to source number 10, in Bamidbar Perek Yud Bet, when Moshe and Aaron were speaking Lashon Hara about Moshe, and Hashem comes to Moshe's defense, and he says, Lochin Pasuk Zayin, Lochin Avdi Moshe, B'chol Biti Ne'emanhu. Right? Not so is my servant Moshe. He is Ne'eman. He is faithful of all my house. So too is Shmuel in source number 11. In Perek Gimel Pasuk Chaf, Ki ne'eman Shmuel l'navi l'Hashem. Shmuel is also described as a faithful prophet to Hashem. And finally, they're both described as being with Hashem. With Moshe, this is in source number 12, when Hashem tells him after he refused every single time, basically, all five times after which Moshe refused to fulfill Hashem's shlichut, to fulfill Hashem's mission to become leader of Bnei Yisrael and Mitzrayim, Hashem's response was a variation of Perek Gimel Pasuk Yedbet, Ki ehaya imach. You don't have to worry, I'm going to be with you. And Shmuel is described in the same way. I'm sorry, we're going to have to go back a little bit to source number 11. In Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Tet, V'Hashem Haya Imo. Hashem was with Shmuel as well. So far we have put forth a total of 13 similarities between Moshe and Shmuel. However, not one of them is unique to Moshe and Shmuel. Every single similarity that I've just put forth can be found in another character in Tanakh. Just to give you a few examples, because I don't want to bore you by going through all 13, but all leaders of Bnei Yisrael, from the time of Moshe through the time of Shlomo HaMelech, presided over a unified Bnei Yisrael. Sorry, but Moshe and Shmuel were not the only leaders who did so. Several people in Tanakh responded to Hashem's call with Hineni. For example, Avraham Avinu. Many leaders in Bnei Yisrael inspired them to get rid of their Avodah Zarah, Chizkiyahu, Yoshiyahu, I mean, many, many leaders. And there are also other leaders who are described as Ne'aman, such as David and Avraham. Is there any parallel or similarity between Moshe and Shmuel that is unique to the two of them? Because that, to me, would really answer the question of why it's that these two particular leaders who are parallel to each other in two different psukim in Tanakh. Is there anything that is unique to Moshe and Shmuel? And so what I find interesting in both cases is that both Moshe and Shmuel, and this is unique to the two of them to the extent with which we'll see it with the two of them, is that they succeeded in leading Bnei Yisrael through major transitions in our history. Not just into a new era, which is fine and nice, and many leaders, you know, usher in a new era, but Moshe and Shmuel together, or not together, but they both, parallelly, that's not a word, but they both led Bnei Yisrael from a time of chaos, a time of affliction, a time of uncertainty, to a time of security, to a time of order, to a time of tranquility. We know that Moshe Rabbeinu took a people who had suffered for so long at the hands of the Egyptians, who were afflicting them and embittering their lives, and he took them out. He freed them. He brought them through the Midbar under Hashem's protection to their promised land, to the cusp of entering the promised land. Shmuel did something very similar, albeit a little different. He took Bnei Yisrael not from a time of chaos as much physically as much as spiritually. The lawlessness that was rampant in the times of the Shoftim was terrible. Right, the way that the Shoftim era is described is ish asher yashar be'inav yaseh. Every single individual living during that time period did whatever they wanted. Well, when everyone does what they want, we know that that leads to the breakdown of society. That leads to disorder and chaos and a lack of peace. As we see, almost every minute in Sefer Shoftim, another enemy is coming down upon Bnei Yisrael to afflict them. And what Shmuel successfully did was he took the people from this chaotic, insecure time period, and brought them to the time period of the Melachim, the time period in which we finally were unified under one leader, in which David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech and even Shmuel, as we'll see in a moment, was able to create an era of peace from their surrounding enemies, to create structured order where before there was lawlessness. Both Moshe and Shmuel succeeded in taking a nation that was literally falling apart at the seams, because of their physical affliction, but also because of their spiritual decline. They had disconnected from each other, and they had disconnected from Hashem. And they both were able to mold that nation into a peaceful, cohesive, and spiritually connected one. Let's just go through that in a little bit more depth for a moment. But we know that in Mitzrayim, B'nai Israel had distanced themselves so much from Hashem that they were worshiping Avodah Zarah. They were completely influenced by the Mitzrim around them. They had lost contact with God. In fact, in the Psukim in Shmot Perak Aleph, in which the Shibud, in which the enslavement is described, there is not one mention of Shem Hashem. We do not encounter the name of God anywhere in those Psukim. And Nechama Leibovitz points out that it is done intentionally by Hashem, when he wrote the Torah, in order to reflect B'nai Yisrael's sense of abandonment by him at that time. And so B'nai Yisrael were so far gone, they had no connection with Hashem, and they also lost their connection with each other. In fact, one of my favorite things to teach when I teach Sefer Shemot is, you know, why do we have the Karban Pesach? Why is there so much emphasis on the Mishpacha? Why is there so much emphasis at the Seder that we're all together with family? And the reason why is because that's undoing what the slavery had did. The slavery had completely torn apart families. Relationships were completely severed. Because if one master wanted one particular slave, he didn't care what family they belonged to. He took the slave for himself. Or even if they were living together in the same homes, they were too exhausted by the time they got home to have a nice heart-to-heart. And so the relationships were in shambles. They were disconnected from Hashem. They were disconnected from each other. And as we know, there was terrible affliction from the enemy. Terrible. What Moshe was able to do, right, through taking them out of Mitzrayim, physically freeing them from that affliction, but also building up towards Matan Torah, entering them into Brit Sinai, was to reconnect them to each other and reconnect them to Hashem through the Mitzvah Ben Adam L'Chaveiro and the Mitzvah Ben Adam L'Makom. Similarly, Shmuel was able to reconnect the people to form a cohesive unit after generations and generations of Ish Asher Yashar Ve'Einav Yaseh. Which, by the way, that attitude of each man for his own culminated in civil war. The people of B'nai Israel were killing each other. Forget about the enemies from without. There were enemies from within. And Shmuel was able to take the people from this complete lawlessness, from this complete disconnect, and bring them closer to each other. We also know that during the times of the Shoftim, there was a cycle, right? Gilgal HaChozer. And we know that every time they won a war, they were okay, and then they stopped believing in Hashem again, and then they cried out, and then Hashem sent them a shofate. Then they won, then they were okay, until they started believing in Avodah Zarah again. And it was a repetitive cycle, a downward cycle. And so what Shmuel was able to do as well, as we saw before, was take the Avodah Zarah away from them. And they listened. If you turn back to source number 9, at the end of page 3, B'nai Yisrael's response to Shmuel's request, Vayasiru B'nai Yisrael et ha-ba'alim ve'et ha-ashtarot ve'yavdu et Hashem levado. They did in fact listen to Shmuel. They got rid of the Avodah Zarah, and they worshipped Hashem alone. And so Shmuel, just like Moshe, was able to free them from this affliction from their enemy, at the same time as reconnecting them to each other as a cohesive whole, and also to Hashem. It's not surprising then that another parallel that exists between Moshe and Shmuel, that I'd like to argue doesn't exist with anyone else in Tanakh, is that during their Nivuot Hakdasha, when Hashem appears to them for the first time to initiate them into Navihood, so to speak, they don't know who Hashem is. We have refusals in almost every Nivuot Hakdasha in Tanakh. Every Navi is too humble. No, it's not for me. Yirmiyahu says no. Yeshayahu says no. None of them say, wait, who are you? Except for Moshe and Shmuel. If you turn to source number 7, same page, page number 3. When Moshe was on Har Sinai, which is, by the way, linguistically connected to the word sneh, okay, and Horev is Har Sinai, in Pasuk Bet in Perek Gimel, Vayira Malach Hashem Elav Bilabat Ish Mitoch HaSneh. There is a fire in the sneh. Vayar V'hineis HaSneh Bo'er Ba'esh V'HaSneh Inenu Ukal. And Moshe recognized something a little bit off about this burning bush, because it was burning, but it wasn't being consumed. In other words, it was obviously not a natural, physical fire. Vayomer Moshe, what was his first response? Asurana. Ve'er'eh tamar'eh hagadol hazeh, madua lo yivar hasneh. His first response isn't, oh yeah, that's a spiritual fire, Hashem's here. No, it's what is going on here. Let me get a closer look. Shmuel, in the next source, in source number 8, has a similar experience. In Pasuk Dali, when Hashem calls to him and he says, Hineni, who does he think is speaking to him? In Pasuk Hey, Vayarat al Eli. Vayomer Hineni, ki karatali. Shmuel runs to Eli, who's in the next room, and says, oh, I'm here. What do you want? And this happens 3 times. before Eli finally tells him, okay, next time this happens, just tell Hashem that you're ready to respond, that you're ready to do what he wants. And so we see that both Moshe and Shmuel are at first caught unaware. They're not aware that Hashem, who Hashem is. And perhaps this is due to the fact that their uniqueness is that they were the ones destined to transition Bnei Israel from a place of lacking in terms of their relationship with God to a place where there was something concrete and real. Perhaps because they were originally within this environment in which Hashem was so distant from all of them, so distant from everyone, they themselves, who were ultimately going to be the leaders to lead everyone else back to Hashem, but when Hashem first appeared to them, they couldn't even fathom the idea that Hashem was in their midst, because the people around them felt so distant from him. What I'd like to explore is how Moshe and Shmuel were uniquely suited to lead Bnei Israel through this transition. We said that both of them were unique in that they led Bnei Israel through this major transition in their history from a terrible place to a wonderful place. But why specifically them? Why specifically Moshe and Shmuel? In order to answer this question, I first want to actually point you to source number 13. Rav Adin Steinsaltz, who is the rabbi who translated the Gemara into Hebrew, but he was one of the great rabbis of the day. He wrote a book called Biblical Images, in which he kind of gives you he writes an essay on each biblical character. And just to give you a sense, just to kind of sum up before we address our question, to sum up the kind of transition that Moshe and Shmuel were able to bring about. If you turn to source number 13, I think he says it beautifully. More than most men who are aware of social need and take on the challenge of meeting it, Shmuel was wholly and wholeheartedly involved in his mission. Hence the saying that Shmuel is akin to both Moshe and Aaron. Just as Bnei Israel were slaves in Mitzrayim, so too Yisrael at the time of the Shoftim was a slave people bound to the earth with no clear vision of heaven. So here, by the way, he gives us yet another parallel between their two time periods. If Bnei Israel at the time of Mitzrayim were enslaved to the masters of the Mitzrim, the people at the time of the Shoftim were beholden to the labors of the land. It was Shmuel who initiated the religious renaissance of his generation, thus filling the role of both Moshe and Aaron. And so he explains that the reason why Moshe and Shmuel are parallel is because they each led a religious renaissance. They literally flipped the nation on its head in order to reconnect them. But again, getting back to our question, how were they able to do this? What is it about Moshe and Shmuel specifically that enabled them to lead Bnei Israel through such a huge transition in their history? And I'd like to suggest that perhaps the reason why it was specifically Moshe and Shmuel who were able to do this is because they are two people who are unique in experiencing a major transition of their own as children. In all of Tanakh, Moshe and Shmuel are the only people we know who were torn away from their mothers at the age of 3, while their mothers were still alive, and raised in atypical yet extraordinary homes by extraordinary leaders of the time. Yocheved had to give up Moshe, but let's recall, she also got to nurse him for 3 years, because Miriam told Bat Paro, oh, I'll get a nursing woman for you, and then found his mother. So Yocheved was able to spend 3 years with Moshe, but then she had to give him up. And he was raised in none other than the ancient Egyptian palace, which was arguably the most powerful place in the entire known world at the time. Shmuel was given up by his mother also at age 3. By the way, there is a significance to age 3. It's because in ancient times they used to nurse until age 3, and then when they're weaned, they have the physical capacity to no longer live with their mothers. And he was given to the Mishkan, another extraordinary home, and also being raised by an extraordinary leader at the time, the Kohen Gadol, Eli. There are other characters in Tanakh who have to leave their homes, but no one has to at age 3. Avraham leaves his home, but he's much older. Yaakov leaves his home, he's also reached adulthood. None were torn from their living mothers and brought to another home at a young, impressionable age, to be raised by others. We can understand that that would be a very, very traumatic experience for any child of that age. we would expect that that kind of trauma, like any major transition, would deeply impact that child. For some, it may weaken them, right? If we think PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, any other host of other things that can come up. But it can also, alternatively, serve to strengthen him immeasurably. In her famous parenting book based on Jewish teachings, Wendy Mogul, in The Blessing of a Skinned Knee, discusses this. And she actually suggests that it is through experiencing stresses in our lives, even traumas, that a child, when forced to work through things on their own, can actually emerge stronger and be able to forge their own path in life and be able to not have their parents call their freshman year professor telling him, why did you give my daughter a B and not an A? Right? It's in response to helicopter parenting, etc. But if this child emerges stronger from the challenging experience, his newfound strength can really serve not only to emotionally bolster himself in his own life, but perhaps if he one day through that strength becomes a leader of a people, it can help him lead those people through transitions in their own lives as well. I definitely think that Moshe and Shmuel's successes later in life prove to us that they were not weakened by their trauma, but rather were of the ilk that were strengthened by it. They were so successful at navigating change through B'nai Israel's history in their particular eras that I think it's quite obvious that even though that they were deeply impacted by their trauma and transition and that they emerged stronger because of it. But I still don't think it ends there. Because as we discussed, they didn't just experience trauma. There are consequences to the transition in their three-year-old lives. And that is that they each grew up in these extraordinary homes with extraordinary leaders of the highest strata of society. It's no coincidence that the two greatest leaders of all time grew up with two of the greatest leaders of their time. So you can say, okay, amazing. They are such great leaders because they learned great leadership skills. Right? What better person to learn great leadership skills than the head of the entire Egyptian empire or their greatest religious leader of the time in the Mishkan? But the Ibn Ezra probes even further and suggests that living in the palace, and we're gonna apply it to Shmuel in a moment, might have had even deeper repercussions for Moshe Rabbeinu than just learning leadership skills. In source number 14, the Ibn Ezra tells us, poetically introducing his thoughts with "Umachshavot Hashem amku umi yuchal la'amod b'sodo v'lo levan et kenu alilot." In other words, Hashem's brilliant. No one can ever understand his brilliance. "Ulai sibev Hashem ze sheyegadal Moshe b'vet hamalchut." Maybe Hashem caused this on purpose that Moshe would be raised in the palace. "Liyot nafsho al madriga ha'elyona," so that his soul would be raised on a higher level. "B'derech halimud v'harigilut." In terms of his education, think about how educated he would have been had he been a slave. But also in terms of regilut, in terms of his manners, in terms of how he interacted with others. Moshe was raised as a royal, and he acted in that way, and he was educated in that way. And this, says the Ibn Ezra, prevented him from developing what the rest of his nation developed, which is known as a slave mentality. When you have a slave mentality, you're worth nothing. You do not have the ability to question. You do not have the ability to think for yourself. You only do what your master tells you. That's why B'nai Israel had such separation anxiety from the Mitzrayim. They couldn't conceive of themselves outside of Mitzrayim. That's what a slave mentality does to you. Ibn Ezra is really obsessed with the slave mentality thing, and he goes on and on throughout Sefer Shemot. But Moshe, says the Ibn Ezra, because he was raised in the palace, was stripped of that. He wasn't exposed to that at all. He was able to think for himself. He was able to have confidence. He viewed himself as having value. But it goes even further. Moshe was able to kill a Mitzri because he was acting immorally. And not only that, but he also did the same thing a few years later, or really a few days later when he ran away to Midian. And he saved the daughters of Yitro from the shepherds who didn't want them to feed their sheep the water. Because they were also acting immorally. Had Moshe grown up a slave, claims the Ibn Ezra, nothing would have seemed out of place. Everything would have been the norm. He wouldn't have questioned anything because that's just not what slaves do. But because he was taught and educated in a way to think for himself, to think highly of himself, to think objectively about the situation, he was able to see, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. And even further, ve'od davar acher, ki ilu haya gadel bein achav ve'akiruhu minurav, if he had grown up amongst his brethren and they would have recognized him since he was a little kid, one of the reasons why I didn't go back to SKA after my first year, oh, that's Tessie's daughter! Right? But if they would have recognized him from the time that he grew up, lo hayu yorei emimenu, they wouldn't have been afraid of him, they wouldn't have been in awe of him. Ki achshivu ke'achameyam, he would have been one of them. And so for all these reasons, says the Ibn Ezra, growing up in the palace was extremely significant in the shaping of Moshe Rabbeinu, in the shaping of Moshe as a leader. And I'd like to argue that the same applies to Shmuel's experience in the Mishkan with Eli. He was raised in the holiest place in the nation. So one would imagine that his moral education would be on the highest possible level. But even further, he didn't just have any random Kohen who lived in the area teaching him. He had the Kohen Gadol, the master teacher, teaching him. And further, he was taught manners, and he was separated from his brethren. Perhaps if he had grown up as one of the boys, he would have either not become a shofet, or maybe if he would have become a shofet, he would have had the same fate as the rest of them. His influence short-lived, and B'nai Shal going back to the way that they were. But because Shmuel was raised separately, and they looked up to him as someone who was a little different, who was on a higher level, who was holy, they interacted with him in a different way, and they responded to his leadership in a different way. So far, therefore, we have focused on Moshe and Shmuel's unique ability to lead their nation through transition, as perhaps being due to the fact that they themselves experienced a unique transition in their own lives, and in the consequence that developed from there. But we are forgetting one piece of it, and that is their mothers. What happened before they were given up at age 3? They were raised by heroines in their own right, by Chana and Yocheved. At first glance, the only thing that Yocheved and Chana seem to have in common is that they gave up their children at age 3. They did so for the sake of their lives. Moshe, in order to save his life. Shmuel, in order to create his life. We know that Chana davened to Hashem for a son, and as part of her tefillah, offered to give him back to him if Hashem would just lend him to her for 3 years. And therein lies the first major difference between Yocheved and Chana, because Yocheved was forced to give up her son. Chana volunteered, offered to give up her son. And yet there are even more differences. They lived in different places in different times. Yocheved lived in Mitzrayim during the Shibud. Chana lived in Eretz Yisrael, in Ramah, right, in a time of physical, at least, freedom. Yocheved was Amram's only wife. Chana was one of Elkanah's two wives, and she had to deal with all the turmoil that comes along with being one of two wives. Yocheved did not appear to have any trouble conceiving, neither did any women in that time. Vayishtu, vayirbu, vayasmu, bimo, me'od, etc. Chana, on the other hand, was an akara for years. She was barren for years and years. Yocheved's pain commenced only after Moshe was born, because he was born into a horrific world in which killing baby boys was the norm. Whereas Shmuel's birth served to end Chana's pain, because her pain was due to her inability to have children, and Shmuel solved that. Very interestingly, when we are introduced to Yocheved in Sefer Shemot, we are not given any window into her internal world. We don't know anything about her relationship with her husband. I'm sorry, Yocheved. Did I say Yocheved? We're not given any window into her internal world in terms of her relationship with her husband, in terms of her emotions, in terms of her turmoil throughout her entire ideal. What are we focused on? We are focused on her actions. We don't hear her speak. We don't hear one word coming out of her mouth. Let's actually turn now to source number 15. We're not even told her name. If you look at the bolded words throughout, I'm sorry, you're going to have to flip between pages 5 and 6. She's called Bat Levi, she's called Isha, and she's called Aim Hayelet. We don't even know her name until much later in Perek Vav. Oh, by the way, Moshe's mother's name is Yocheved. We're not even told the name that she names her own son. We only know what Bat Paro names him in Pasuk Yud. Right? Kimina Mayim Mishitihu. The only thing, as I said, we're told about Chana is her, about Yocheved is her external world. the world of her actions. And so if you go back to the beginning of source number 15, I underlined all of her actions. Vatitzmenehu, and she hid him. Vatikach, and she took a teva. Vatachmera, and she tarred it. Vatasen vatayelet, and she placed the child within it. Vatasen vasuf, and she placed the teva in the suf. Then she goes away because she cannot see her child die. She cannot handle it. So she sends her daughter instead. Okay, and then when she's called back onto the scene, when she is asked to nurse the child, she, after Bat Paro says, I will pay you for it, which, by the way, is crazy that in the time of Shibud, she's offering to pay her, even though she's a Jew for working. But in Pasuk Tet, Vatika Ha'isha Hayela Vatanikehu, she takes the child and nurses him. Action, 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 action. Everything we know about Yochaved is in her external world of actions. On the other hand, what we see about Hannah and Sefer Shmuel is the exact opposite. If you turn to source number 16, the text describes Hannah's ordeal and her emotions throughout her ordeal time and time again. Look at all the underlined words. V'chiyasata tzarata gam ka'as, her enemy, meaning Penina, the other wife, me, her angry. She was angry and she was crying and she wouldn't eat. Right? And her husband says, Lama tivki, v'lama lo tochli, v'lama yira levavich. Why are you so hurt? Why are you so upset? And in Pasuk Yod, v'himarat nefesh. And she was bitter of heart. V'tipalel al Hashem v'acho tivke. And she davens. And she cries. Right? Ra'ot tir'e be'ani amatecha. See the affliction of your maidservant. And then in Pasuk Tetvav, Ishak shat ruach anochi. I'm a woman of heavy or hardened spirit. Pasuk Tetzai, Sichi v'cha'asi, right? All this anger bottling up inside her. We're only given a window into her emotions, and her words become the epicenter of the perek. Her words, when she pours out her words to Hashem, Vatit Palel, right? I underlined them before. In Pasuk Yud, right? V'himarat nevesh v'tipalel al Hashem v'vacho tifke. V'chana hi Pasuk Yud Gimel v'chana hi midaberet aliba rak sfateha na'ot v'kola lo yishama. For Yochaved, we don't hear any words. We don't hear about any emotions. And for Chana, it's the opposite. It's all about her words and it's all about her emotions. In fact, we're told Chana's name from the moment she's introduced to us. Right, if you just glance through all the bolded times in the words in the parak, in which we're told that her name is Hannah. And then as soon as Shmuel is born, sorry, flip to page 7, the last line in source number 16, Vatikra Shmuel Shmuel. She names her son. And so it seems that Hannah and Yochaved are quite the opposite. We're told everything about Yochaved's external life, nothing about her internal life. We're told everything about Hannah's internal life, not much about her external life. It seems that they couldn't be more different. And yet, if we look closely, there are three values that they did share. The first value that I'd like to discuss is that both women thought outside the box. Both Yochaved and Hannah pushed against the norms of society at the time. And they did what no one else did. Right? As we discussed, Yochaved, as is not so surprising, Yochaved did so through her actions. In a society in which the Mitzrim's hunting down of every single baby boy who was born had horrifyingly become the norm. In a society in which most Jewish mothers who had their babies obviously loved them, but felt that beyond that they couldn't do anything except for fervently hope and, you know, except for fervently hope for the best. And unfortunately we know that it usually ended with the worst. In that society, in that cultural context, Yochaved did the unthinkable. She defied the Mitzrim in order to save her son, in order to save her infant's life at great risk to her own. She hides her son, and then she dares put him in the Nile, the Egyptian's god. She acts. She hides him. She then exposes him, all in the name of saving him. She was the only one in her entire generation of women, which is the reason why it's written in the text of Tanakh, who performed what we now call civil disobedience, defying the Mitzrim quietly in a very, very brave attempt to save the life of her son. And of course we know that according to the Midrash, Yochaved was one of the Mialdot. One of the Mialdot who very much in front of Paro's face defied him by not listening to his command to kill the baby boys. And so we see it's very clear that Yochaved spent her life, or at least the part of her life that we know about, thinking outside the box, pushing against the norms of society at the time. Well, Hannah did something very, very similar. But Hannah did so through her words. Because before Hannah, we know that not one person in Bnei Israel davened to themselves quietly. Everything about ritual was done publicly. You brought karbanot publicly. If you wanted to daven, it was publicly. The proof of this is that when Eli sees Hannah davening to herself, if you flip the page back, I apologize, to page 6, but still source number 16, and we're told in Pasuk Yud Gimel, V'chana hi medaberet aliba, rak shfatah na'ot v'kola lo yishama, she's speaking to herself, only her lips are moving, but you couldn't hear her voice. V'yachsheveha Eli l'shikora. This was so beyond the norm at the time that Eli automatically assumed she must be drunk, because no one does this. And Eli said, how dare you? How long are you going to be drunk for? Take your wine away from you. How dare you, says Eli. Because he couldn't even fathom that what she was doing was tefillah. And yet, despite the fact that no one in society did daven to Hashem privately, personally, quietly, Hannah intuited that that was the best way to do so. And it was this personal, private, silent tefillah that ultimately begot her son Shmuel, and that ultimately was chosen as the paradigm of tefillah for all time by Chazal. That's the first value that both women share, that both Hannah and Yocheved pushed against the norms of society at the time. The second value that Hannah and Yocheved share are that both women connected to Hashem when no one else around them did. How so? Yocheved, as we discussed, lived in an environment where no one feared Hashem. They were all completely immersed in the Avodah Zarah at the time, completely assimilated. The Mitzrayim obviously didn't believe in Hashem. The Jews themselves didn't believe in Hashem. We pointed out that the Nechama Leibowitz explained that they felt abandoned by Hashem at the time. Yocheved, though, was able to recognize Hashem despite the really bleak surroundings. And we know this, or at least one insight we gain into this, is because of the water-going vessel she specifically chooses to fashion for her newborn son. She could have created anything, an aniya, a mini sfina, right? All different kinds of boats. And yet, the Ibn Ezra, well, not, let me put it a different way. She creates, of all things, a teva. What makes a teva unique from other sea-going vessels? Turn to the Ibn Ezra in source number 17. The Ibn Ezra explains, V'shem teva v'lo sfina, it's called a teva, he's actually commenting on Parshat Noach, but it's the same word. V'shem teva v'lo sfina, it's called a teva, not a ship or a boat, ki enena atzurat aniyah, because it doesn't share the same form as a boat. V'ein la mishutim, and because there are no oars. Well, what does an oar provide us? Steering capacity, being able to control where we're going. Rav Michael Haddon, who's an instructor at Pardes and also contributes to Yeshivat Har Etzion's virtual Beit Midrash, suggests that the reason why Yocheved placed Moshe specifically in a teva was to send the message to Hashem, he's in your hands. There's nothing more I could do. I can't determine the direction of his fate anymore. So Hashem, I leave him to you. Please save him the way that you saved Noah in the teva. And again, we can't ignore the famous midrash that Yocheved was one of the Mialdot, of whom it says, after we don't see Shem Hashem for an entire slew of psukim, suddenly when we're introduced to the Mialdot, v'tirena ha-Mialdot et ha-Elokim. The first time we see Hashem's name is when we're introduced to the midwives, because they feared Hashem instead of Paro. And so we see that Yocheved, in the midst of a very bleak horizon spiritually, was able to see and connect to Hashem. Hannah, in contrast, did live in a society where the people around her recognized Hashem, but they lost their connection to him. They may have believed he existed, but they wanted to worship other gods too. They didn't really feel so excited about all the ritual that was surrounding the Mishkan. Public worship at the time had become stale. In fact, Rav Steinzel suggests that the spiritual atmosphere of the Mishkan at the time was one of sloth, sleepiness, gluttony, and above all, vast indifference. Despite her cultural context, or perhaps inspired by its lacking, Hannah became the first true mitpalelet, the first true davener, the first one to truly reach out to Hashem on a personal level and pour out her heart to him. Va'ashpoch, she says, va'ashpoch, if you turn to the end of source number, same page, source number 16, the top line of page 7, va'ashpoch et nafshi lifnei Hashem. She literally poured out her heart to Hashem. Hannah instinctively understood that the spontaneous, passionate davening was the best way to connect to Hashem. It was the best and the only way to do so on a personal level. And that's why she did it, even though no one else was doing so. And the third and final value that we see parallel between Yochaveh and Hannah is one which we alluded to before, which is the ultimate sacrifice. They both sacrificed their children for a chance at life, for a chance at their sons' lives, and ultimately, we know, for the good of their nation. So these values of Yochaveh and Hannah, pushing against the norms of the day, connecting to Hashem, even though no one else did, which is, I guess, similar, and finally, that of sacrifice, were of extreme significance. Those are very important values, and were no doubt very impactful on their own lives, on the lives of their generation. But were they with their children long enough to be able to impart these values to them? Were these little boys who were torn from them at age 3 able to learn everything that they could? Our first thought may be no way, right? When do memories begin to form? After age 3, right? Before age 3, I don't know if she's still in the room, but my son's occupational therapist was here earlier, maybe now, and came to the table because she hadn't seen him since he was 3, and he's now 4.5, and he has no clue. Not a clue who she was, who she used to be. He literally saw her every week of his life. Not a clue. So we might say, there's no way. You leave at 3, you lost the opportunity. However, if we look closely at Moshe and Shmuel's lives, we will see that each of these values were very much internalized by each of them. Even though they left their moms at such an early age, we see that they still left indelible marks upon their souls. So let's start with Moshe Rabbeinu. He pushes against the norms of society. We discussed that already. As soon as he leaves the palace, he kills a Mitzri. Okay, he leaves the Egyptian palace and then kills an Egyptian. And he does so in the name of immorality. From the very beginning of his adult life, when he matures into an individually thinking individual, that was a little bit repetitive, he goes against the norms of society. He engages subsequently in 2 more episodes of defending helpless victims. And in each case, he pushes against what everyone else has accepted as the norm, what everyone else has accepted as okay. And he says, no, it's not okay. Even though you may think it is, it's not. He also connected to Hashem when no one else did. Yes, he refused him 5 times, but he ultimately accepted at a time when B'nai Israel wouldn't even hear of it. They couldn't connect to him. They cried out, but not to Hashem. Hashem heard it because he didn't expect a complete 180 in a few minutes. But B'nai Israel were not connected to God at the time. Moshe did. And he's the one who brought them back. And finally, as can be learned from his 40-year experience in leading B'nai Yishal, Moshe sacrificed a lot. He sacrificed his family life, as we know, in terms of his relationship with his wife, in terms of his relationship with his own 2 sons. And he even had to sacrifice, ultimately, his very strong desire to enter into Eretz Yisrael. In Shmuel, we also see Hannah's fervent spirituality and soul. Like his mother, he pushed against the norms of society. Let's just see it in source number 18, because I think that Rabbi Dinstein's also just really captures it. To Samuel, the sanctuary, the ritual and worship were not old customs, even though everyone else at the time just thought of them as ancient, universally accepted even if in disrepute, but a source of inspiration and enlightenment. His task went beyond that of priest to that of prophet. He was a man with a vision that consisted of a renewal of the ancient faith. Shmuel said things that were not new, but he said them with new emphasis. And elements of his prophecy have become part of Jewish religious consciousness. He revived the idea, which became a point of departure for later prophets, that ritual was not a substitute for the spiritual aspects of religion. He was outraged by its denigration into empty ceremony and by the neglect of discipline of living according to divine commandment. In short, Shmuel returned to the basic elements of Jewish faith, a way of life that was total and obligatory. After generations of decline in which the people were sunk in ignorance and spiritual sloth, Shmuel was the first seriously to relate to his own spiritual world. Just like Hannah, who in the midst of people who were just doing things by rote, doing things because that's just what you did. Hannah, enlightened, inspired, related to Hashem in a new way. In a way that was different than everyone else. Shmuel did the same, and he pushed others to do so as well. And he did that, by the way, just like Hannah, through connecting to Hashem. His sacrifice is also seen throughout his leadership. He would travel around the entire country just to judge the people and hear their cases. And he even appointed a king when he didn't want to, because the people had asked it of him. Indeed, modern research corroborates what we have just learned from Moshe and Shmuel themselves. In a joint study by the University of Minnesota, the University of Delaware, and actually the University of Illinois, they followed over 240 individuals from birth through adulthood for over 30 years of their lives. And they found that the way that a parent raises their child from ages 0 through 3 will not only impact them through the rest of their childhood, but into adulthood and for the rest of their lives as well. I very strongly believe that it was the internalization of these important values that Chana and Yocheved were able to impart to their sons, even in the short 3 years they had with them, that strengthened Moshe and Shmuel and enabled them to be the leaders that they were. In addition to their having experienced a major transition in their own lives, and also the consequences of that, in that they were raised in homes of leadership and of manners and of, you know, higher level thinking. And so we see that, in fact, mothers do have a very long-lasting influence upon their children, no matter what the nature or length of time or distance of the relationship is. All we need to know, we learn from our mothers.